WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The holiday season is also the season of the 10 Best list, so this time of year we like to invite our rock and film critics to talk with us about their impressions of the year. First, we'll talk with Fresh Air's film critic, David Edelstein. He's also the film critic for the online magazine Slate. David Edelstein, welcome. We asked you to bring your 10 Best list, and you haven't been totally compliant because what you've brought isn't exactly 10.
No, I go to 11 every year. This is, I admire people who can put them all into neat little 10 movie boxes, but I normally go to 11, and now I've decided to make 11 the rule. And also that way, if I have one there that a few years later is just completely outlandish, I can just go, well, what do you want? It was the 11th movie, you know? I mean, it was sort of like last year, Gangs of New York, you know? It was 11. Doesn't count.
Would you read your 10 best list for us?
With pleasure. My number one movie of the year is a documentary called Spellbound. That's followed by The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, then Jim Sheridan's In America, then the animated feature The Triplets of Belleville, then Lost in Translation, followed by Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, then Finding Nemo, then The Company, directed by Robert Altman, The Sun, followed by The Dancer Upstairs, and School of Rock.
Thank you. Okay, well, Spellbound, a documentary, is at the top of the list. That's kind of interesting because, you know, not only because it's a documentary topping your list, but it's one of several really good documentaries that came out this year. Name some of the others that were among your favorites.
Well, this has been a great year for documentaries. Capturing the Freedmen certainly could have been on this list. So could a Brazilian documentary called Bus 174. So could a movie called Winged Migrations, which chronicles the flight of birds, which has no narrative whatsoever, and yet I think brings you closer to the real world than just about anything else on screen. I think this is the kind of year in which many of us were a little bit tired of certain kinds of mainstream Hollywood formulas, and we were just looking for a little more ambiguity, a little more open-ended stories, a little movies in which we could bring our own minds and help complete them in our heads. Movies in which we could allow our minds to play with the ingredients in a way that many artists in mainstream movies, well, they really don't let you do it because they have a lot of studio development people sitting on them and saying, no, the audience isn't going to understand that. No, we can't leave them with that ambiguity. No, we have to pin this down. Documentary directors really aren't bound by the same formulas that fictional filmmakers are.
I'll add two other documentaries to your list of films that were really interesting this year, My Architect and The Fog of War, about former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Now, you have two animated films on your 10 best list, The Triplets of Belleville and Finding Nemo. Are they there for their technical achievements or just for their larger qualities as good movies?
No, I would never put something there just for technical reasons. If it doesn't connect with your heart and your mind, then it has no place on any list. The Triplets of Belleville is something that doesn't even make a lot of sense. It's about a grandma whose boy is kidnapped from the Tour de France by French wine-drinking gangsters and taken to a distant metropolis across the ocean. And it's about how she and her train-loving dog fall in with these three ancient frog-slurping sisters who used to be nightclub chanteuses and still are in a way. And there's no... I don't really understand what the movie is about, but I was reading a very interesting memoir the other day about the making of the Sondheim musical Follies by Ted Chapin, and there's just this little throwaway passage about the great caricaturist Al Hirschfeld, who drew the opening week Alexis Smith crossing the stage and doing this little twist with her waist. And the author says that he'd seen her make that cross about 100 times, and he'd never registered that thing she was doing, and it illuminated her entire personality. He'd never seen it until he saw it through the eyes of Al Hirschfeld. And that's what I felt when I saw Triplets of Belleville. I felt like I'd never seen the human form until I'd seen it through the eyes of Sylvain Chomet, who's the director. I'd never seen the sort of deco, the sort of surreal deco hallucination of a 20s nightclub in the same way. I'd never seen a bicycle in the same way. I'd never seen a calf muscle in the same way. I mean, this is a movie that kind of brings you as close to the inner reality, even closer, as any surreal masterpiece by David Lynch.
Now, Lost in Translation is on your list. I know that although it's on your top 10 list, you're a little conflicted about the movie. What's your conflict?
Yeah, I'm very conflicted about it. On one hand, it's a mood piece that I think is really transfixing. It's kind of a poem of alienation and then connection between an older man and a younger woman. On the other hand, there's something narcissistic and entitled about Sofia Coppola's two protagonists that isn't a great advertisement for Americans abroad. It's almost as if the sense of otherness and of cultural superiority merges a little uncomfortably for my taste. On the other hand, it's the great Bill Murray performance. It's the one we've been waiting for. It seems to me that it merged the two halves of Bill Murray in a way that we've never seen before. It connects his kind of his detachment, which is what's so hilarious about him, and the kind of sense of isolation that must have spawned that detachment, which, you know, I thought of it as Saturday Night Live meets Chekhov.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Now, Lord of the Rings is on your 10 best list. I'll be honest with you, I can't bring myself to see any of the Lord of the Rings movies. I'm one of those people who, like in college, I figured, okay, I'll read The Hobbit. And after about 100 pages, I thought, okay, I won't read The Hobbit. I couldn't keep interested in it. So I figured, why would I go see the movie?
Well, Terry, you did better than me.
You couldn't even get that far.
You did better than me with Tolkien. Uh-huh. You know, it's funny. I have friends who I respect a great deal who have read this thing in all its parts 4, 5, 6 times. I'm not kidding. And I've always wanted to, and I've tried. But there's something about, I just have to read the words Bilbo Baggins of Bag Ends, and my eyelids get very heavy, you know. It's just, you know, I drop over the book, and this is great movie making, and I think that you don't have to be a Tolkien file in order to understand the greatness of Peter Jackson's filmmaking. This is a man who simply makes war pictures on a scale that modern filmmakers have forgotten. It reminds you of Eisenstein or Kurosawa or Orson Welles in his great Falstaff film called Chimes at War. Nobody mixes up perspectives the way he does, so that you start with something very tiny like a worm or a rock, and then you move to hundreds of thousands of demonic orcs crashing across the battlefield with giant trolls and big winged dragons and 7-story elephants, and then you're back to somebody's eyes, and then you're back to something really small, and then something huge, and it's the weave that is so exciting and transporting about this filmmaking. Also, you know, he may have 8 different special effects things going on, elaborate things going on in a shot, and yet his camera retains a kind of handheld documentary feel. You really think that he's just sort of happened on this incredible activity rather than that he's staged it and he's caught it the way a documentary filmmaker would. It's great and exciting filmmaking. I should tell you, I know this because one of the highlights of my movie-going year was going to the Lord of the Rings Marathon. Do you know about the Lord of the Rings Marathon?
No, I guess I was hiding from that one.
People lined up for days to get tickets, to sit in a theater and watch not just the regular cuts, but the extended cuts of all 3 movies, of the first 2 movies, followed by the 3rd movie. And it ended up being about 14 and a half hours in the theater. And I just want to tell you, I loved every second of it. It was, movie audiences are so non-committal. But to get them to hang out somewhere for 14 hours and just kind of groove on each other's presence, on each other's enthusiasm and passion, I learned so much from watching these movies in the company of these people who had sacrificed so much of their time and their money, and they had lied their way out of jobs and played hooky from school just to be in this audience and to drink it in. And then in the middle of it, you know, the 4 of the hobbits came, 3 of the hobbits and 1 golem came, and the audience just raised the roof and went crazy. And then they left, and then the third movie began. And I've just never seen an audience in heaven like that. So that was a really exciting thing. And it can only happen in the movies. It can't happen online, and it can't happen with your TV set. I guess it could happen with Wagner's Ring Cycle. But this is, I guess, the Wagner's Ring Cycle for the modern audience.
My guest is Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein. We'll talk more about the year in movies after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Edelstein, Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Slate, and we're talking about the year in movies. Well, a movie that is absent from your 10 best list I wanted to ask you about is American Splendor. I thought that was one of the best of the year, the movie based on the life and comics of Harvey Pekar.
I loved it, too. I think, you know, that's a movie that ended a little quickly for my taste. Didn't you think that all of a sudden it was over? He had his little bout with cancer, and he turned it into a comic book, and all of a sudden the movie ended. For a while there, it was this wonderful weave of Pekar's comics and the actors making the movie about Pekar and Pekar himself, and it had this amazing performance by Hope Davis as sort of the nerd goddess of all time. And yet somehow I don't know that the movie ever managed, for me anyway, to kind of transcend the raw material in a way that maybe some of Pekar's comic books do at their best. There wasn't that sort of fleeting sense of melancholy and hopelessness that I get when I'm really immersed in a good Pekar comic book.
I thought the ending was very good because, just as you're expecting a kind of nice, tidy, probably happy ending, it kind of undercuts that because things aren't that tidy. Things are still really messy in his life. So
That's true.
Not that I'm hoping that things stay messy in his life, but I thought it didn't deliver a kind of cheap ending in that respect. School of Rock,
you're right,
is on your 10 best list. That was just a really fun, satisfying movie. It takes a lot of predictable elements and makes it into something pretty fresh.
School of Rock is a movie that I literally went out and I grabbed the publicist from Paramount and I said, "Do you realize this is the best movie ever made?" Now, in the light of day, even in the light of evening, I thought that was maybe an extravagant claim. But, you know, remember when you used to go to a rock concert and you would just be so picked up. There would be something so transcendent about what you were watching. There was such a sense of connection. And in this case, you were connected to Richard Linklater and Mike White's sort of love of this dinosaur hard rock genre and Jack Black's kind of touching nostalgia mm-hmm. for an era in which he could be a rock god. And the joke was, of course, he couldn't be a rock god. He could only be a rock god for 10-year-olds. But that was enough. That was beautiful enough. And hey, if you could send your 10-year-olds out into the world with that kind of sense of themselves and what was possible, then that's a pretty good movie.
Well, we've heard your 10 best list. What were some of your biggest disappointments of the year, or the films that most irritated you that you expected more from?
Well, the Cat in the Hat is by far and away the most repulsive thing I've seen all year. Did you see it?
No. What made it so bad?
Oh, it was grotesque. Dr. Seuss's sensibility was very anarchic and very crazy, but it was contained within this sort of beautiful anapestic tetrameter and these designs of just wonderful, these wonderful creatures, these serene creatures who were so happy amid this chaos. This movie was just a sort of loud, crude vaudeville act in which was full of poop jokes and belch jokes and Mike Myers doing an imitation of Bert Lahr's Cowardly Lion, which was completely mystifying. It just seemed to have nothing to do with the original material.
David, let's talk a little bit about films that are opening for the holidays, because I'm sure our listeners will be wanting to see some of those movies.
Well, I certainly would encourage people to see my best film of the year, Spellbound. For those who don't know, it documents the sort of 1999 Nerd Olympics, the nationwide spelling bee contestants assembling in Washington. This is a movie that is as... it's competition, it's history, it's sociology, it's deeply humanistic portraits, it's meditations on the language, it's killer suspense, it's intense heartbreak. I just don't think there's anything in fictional film that can compare to it. And it's available now for rental. I also would encourage people to see The Company, which is Robert Altman's semi-fictional, semi-documentary portrait of the Joffrey Ballet with Neve Campbell stuck in the middle of it. This is a movie that does not have much of a narrative. In fact, I found the narrative a little frustrating in spots, especially at the ending. But what I love best about it is, you know, here's this filmmaker, Robert Altman, who has what seems to be the loosest frame in movies. Everything's off-center and in flux and babbling and indirect, and you're always working to pick out the narrative threads. And yet, here he is shooting ballet in which every muscle of these people is choreographed. And his framing, it feels just as uninsistent, and yet nobody in the last few decades has captured dance with this kind of alertness and sort of rhapsodic alertness. It's an absolutely exhilarating movie, but don't expect to come out knowing exactly what happened in the storyline, because that's not the movie's strong suit. You won't get one of these great ripping soap opera yarns like The Turning Point or The Red Shoes.
So the company's opening on Christmas Day, but that's a pretty select run, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I think so. If you want to see Christmas Day, we have Cold Mountain is opening, and it's a movie that doesn't really work until about midway through, when the sort of very conventional melodrama kicks in. But I think it's beautifully done, and it's harrowing, and it's a terrific ensemble, even though some of them are Miramax actors kind of doing a guest hillbilly thing. But I think a movie with that kind of complex a view of war is important for people to see right now.
Would you recommend Something's Gotta Give, the new comedy with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton?
I would recommend Something's Gotta Give very guardedly if you want to see these two old pros playing with each other, having fun, transcending age, transcending the formula conventions of a certain kind of mainstream film screwball comedy. I think there's just a great deal of pleasure in seeing Diane Keaton in this film playing a woman who is much less dithery and neurasthenic than we recall from her Annie Hall days, playing a woman who actually is very tart, very defended, very funny and strident, but also has, of course, a hysterical side, this being Diane Keaton. I think it's a beautiful love letter to Diane Keaton, this movie, and Jack Nicholson abets her superbly.
David, would you say this has been a good or a bad year for film overall?
I think this has been a wonderful year for film, and I say that not really knowing what the hell was going to be on my 10 best list this year, because I really could have picked 20 or 25 films that I wanted to recommend to people. I don't know that I feel as strongly about any film this year as I did about The Pianist last year, or some of the films in the last few years, like In the Bedroom or the Robert Duvall film, The Apostle. But I think it's a very healthy film culture right now outside the major studios. In the major studios, I'm worried. One of the most disturbing things for me this year was that a lot of people inside the studios thought of Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, as an art film. They thought it was a film that might not have quite the box office potential because it was such a serious grown-up movie. Now, look, Master and Commander is a popcorn movie if ever I saw one. It's a really smart popcorn movie. But, you know, there's nothing different in Master and Commander. There's nothing you can't find in Star Trek The Next Generation or in some of the old Horatio Hornblower books. You know, it's exactly what a good mainstream Saturday matinee kind of entertainment should be. And the fact that it was perceived in Hollywood as this grown-up art film is a little disturbing to me. It maybe explains why we see so many movies coming out this year based on video games.
Well, David, I hope you have a very good new year.
And, thank you very much, Terry.
I hope we all get to see some good movies in the new year.
Thank you, Terry.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. You can find his 10 best list on our website, freshair.com. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.